Hello, Donald. Can you hear me?
Good evening.
All righty. Well, everything is rolling here. Our equipment's working fine. Let me introduce you. We are speaking this evening with a venerable researcher, Donald Freed, who, along with Raymond Biggs, is the co-author of the book Killing Time, Who Murdered Nicole Simpson, Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman, The First Full Investigation, published in hardcover by Macmillan Books. Donald, I want to thank you and welcome. Thank you for your work over the years. I want to welcome you to our airwaves. For me, this is an exciting interview because when I began doing this research many years ago, among the many sources of inspiration for my work, was your work way back in the 1970s. I was reading some of the fantastic material that you've been involved in authoring, and I've it's been my pleasure and privilege to access some of that to my audience. So once again, welcome to our airwaves, and thanks for your work.
Well, thank you, because I, in turn, have been listening to your sort of national radio dialogue for some time, and then comparing notes with others who listen.
Alrighty, well, this is sort of like old home week in a sense.
Right.
Now, you have authored a book. This evening we're going to be talking about the O.J. Simpson case. That's something that has occupied an awful lot of media attention, but sadly has not received the attention due it in a lot of important respects. And you, along with Raymond Briggs, a Ph.D., have co-authored a book which sets forth a great many aspects of the O.J. Simpson case that the public has not been told about, and you include, among other things, a detailed analysis of the timeline. We're going to have a chance to touch on that. I thought, Donald, by way of initiating the discussion on your book, that I would read from page 17. There are a couple of paragraphs in which I think you sum up the not only thesis statement of your book, but some of the dilemmas that have faced investigators, including the prosecution. Reading now from page 17 of Killing Time, The First Full Investigation by Donald Freed and Raymond Briggs, Ph.D. The prosecution's overarching theme and thesis of the crime is homicidal jealousy, beginning with the smoldering rage of the defendant at young Sidney Simpson's dance recital. This scenario includes many of the critical items that would be discussed during the trial: a knife, leather gloves, a dark knit hat, a white Ford Bronco, Bruno Mali shoes, bloody socks, an air conditioner, and a waiting limousine and driver. However, you will note as we proceed that virtually every phrase in this first draft of the prosecution's case would be amended and in some cases deleted. In fact, nearly every assertion of the prosecution, from blood chemistry to the psychology of obsessive jealousy to the philosophy of gender conflict to the farewell note and, quote, slow speed chase, unquote, there would be a profound ambivalence, contradiction, overdetermination, and confusion of conflicting elements, quote, doubleness, unquote, some pointing to guilt, some to innocence, and as we shall see, some to both. The two major bases for the prosecution's case, the jealousy abuse motive and the trail of blood from the Bundy to the Rockingham residence, require separate, in-depth discussion, and the place for that is Chapter 2, and we're going to touch on that in a second. At this point in time, it is the prosecution's storyline that must be accepted by the jury in order to find the defendant guilty. We must be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that O.J. Simpson is guilty of the double murder. One of the things that you and your co-author do is to posit the reader, basically, as the jury. Now, in alluding to the doubleness, Donald, you and your co-author discuss an ambivalence with regard to the prosecution's assessment of O.J. Simpson's motives for allegedly committing these crimes. On the one hand, smoldering rage, an out-of-control, jealous husband, almost an Othello type. And on the other hand, a coolly calculating, cold-blooded killer, so totally in possession of himself that he was able to befuddle all investigators by disposing of the bloody clothes and the murder weapon, despite the fact that he dropped two gloves and a cap at the scene where he supposedly committed the murders. Could you develop that ambivalence for us further?
This term, doubleness, David, as you know, we take from W.E.B. Du Bois, the great, great African-American sociologist, when he wrote in 1903 in a classic book called The Soul of Black Folks. And we might look at that quote a little later on. But doubleness hangs over Mr. Simpson and the other principals in the drama and over the crime. over the police, over a whole culture, indeed, divided by race and other contradictions. And so a crime or an event which began as a kind of tabloid circus, a canvas of sensation and toxic media, a chemistry stirring the various themes and characters together, it began to take on meaning and then to hemorrhage meaning and then to from going from having no meaning to too much meaning and then filling up the country. And now, for in the last year, since the verdict of not guilty, the white educated class has unleashed a torrent of race and rage in their fury at Simpson receiving a not guilty verdict. So that's the context. That's the atmosphere in which this all takes place. And unfortunately, in your program being an exception, the so-called progressive or active organs of the left, the magazines and radio and so on, it appears to be too vulgar, too dangerous an event for serious analysis. But I think that in a democracy, we have to take these events as they come. And you have to grapple with them, especially when they have the power, because of their very vulgarity, to electrify the population. And having just returned from several weeks of basically talking to African-American newspapers and African-American radio networks and stations, as well as a few ordinary white or mainstream stations or television, I can report to you that there is a depth of despair and danger in the country organized along lines of race. Such has not been seen in a long, long time. And because it is subterranean and because the very spokesman who in the past had operated as kind of a vanguard for explaining black America to white America, that is the educated class and the media class, it is that class precisely which has chosen to blame African-American jurors, defendant, and lawyers for, as they say, playing the race card and thus causing a crisis in American justice and American race relations. This began at the very beginning with the blackening of Mr. Simpson's photograph on the cover of Time magazine.
You mentioned in your book, you not only talk about the deliberate darkening of O.J. Simpson's image, but compare it to an earlier piece of photographic journalistic calumny, perhaps we could say, in which another Time Life product, in this case Life magazine, helped to set up Lee Harvey Oswald as the patsy for President Kennedy's assassination.
Well put, this process of demonization, which is so blatant and so vulgar, that the perpetrators are caught, makes you stop, and like the clock striking 13, it makes you question every other facet or snapshot that you think you know about a given event. And so, David, and you're particularly equipped to carry on this conversation, the Simpson affair could be discussed in propaganda terms alone if one wanted to. One could set aside the entire forensics of the case and discuss it as nothing but propaganda and race, and it perhaps deserves that at some other time. I think, though, that we owe it, because there's been so much of this propaganda, we owe it to ourselves to go over some of the actual facts on the ground of the case.
Now, one of the things that, referring again to the doubleness, on the one hand, O.J. Simpson as an out-of-control, impassioned, at least temporary, psychopath, or the image that's been presented, and then on the other hand, a cool, cunning master criminal, able to leap tall buildings in a single bound, as Superman was supposed to have been able to do, and do things that nobody could really do. One of the things that was used by the prosecution, as well as the media, to demonize O.J. Simpson was to discuss his past history of domestic abuse. Now, this is not in any size, shape, form, or manner to excuse domestic abuse or violence by men against women, or what O.J. Simpson on one occasion at least did to Nicole. One of the things you point out in your book, though, is that the handling, both by the media and the prosecution, of the domestic abuse issue was less than objective. Could you tell us about that?
I think so, and I think it's wise of you to bring it up first, because it is that element which prejudiced so many people once the district attorney leaked the 911 tape, and it was played on radio, and leaked a whole series of abuse charges and testimony. It's a very delicate issue. It's not good enough to say abuse is terrible, but it isn't murder. Abuse is terrible, but if he didn't do it, so what? You have an emotional connotation to these charges that has to be faced. I would say this to listeners who are serious about both the case and or propaganda, or both. Take a look at Simpson's depositions. Take a look at how he talks about his relationship. This was a 17-year relationship. It certainly was volatile. And take a look at the interplay of the personalities involved, and the divorce, and come to your own conclusion with your own knowledge of life as to whether it is within or without the parameters of a volatile relationship. Now, you may remember that the prosecution based its entire case on this motive of abuse, but they called no expert, not one. And you may remember that the defense had the leading expert in this matter interview Simpson, and there was, whether she was going to testify for the defense that Simpson did not fit the profile or not, we will never know, because I'd like to mention in passing that Detective Furman not only ruined the case for the prosecution, but for the defense as well, by giving them a cheap and quick and sensational victory, mm-hmm. Which convinced the jury, but which confused the country. And the defense had a large forensic case further to put on, as well as Simpson in person to testify. Now, this matter of abuse and this matter of violence between people in general and between men and women and couples in particular, it does no good to make emblematic a case that has been stereotyped. I mean by that, it can be, and it may be in this case, that there is an equal volatility between the partners, but an unequal physical strength. And that alone, is the determining factor, I would suggest, in the existential situation in these matters, that these are not necessarily moral or ethical or gender issues. Men and women may be equally, more or less, destructive towards themselves and towards each other, but what determines, as in all other cases where power is unequal, that then determines, it seems to me, the logic of behavior. So that, in Simpson's case, we know, for instance, that in the 1989 911 call, to which he pled no contest, both what he said then, what he said now, and what he said since, and what Miss Simpson has said in some of her writings to him and letters to him at different times, seems to paint a picture of an emotional contest wherein his greater physical strength led to a situation which should have then been, shall we say, an inhibition or a taboo for any further relationship if there was not, if they could not overcome this problem. And the 911 call that was played, referring to the 1993 encounter, we now know much more about that. And if you listen carefully to the background of that call, and you read the September issue of Esquire of this year, you will find out that it isn't just roaring and ranting on Simpson's part. He's making references there to, there are words, there are some names, the word hookers appears, There's a drug reference, a National Enquirer reference, and in the September Esquire, wherein Simpson is interviewed in a larger essay about the wealthy west side of Los Angeles, you find that the murders of Don Simpson, a wealthy producer, and his psychiatrist that were originally called overdoses and are now being investigated as homicides, that there are connections between these Don Simpson murders and the O.J. Simpson case. And so what sounds simply like a roaring rage has an actual content to it. Parenthetically, Simpson appears to have believed that Miss Simpson was talking to her mother on the telephone, not to the police. And that's why he's shouting into the phone so that his mother-in-law can hear his complaints about Nicole. And this is typical of their relationship, which included, which was loud and which was verbal and vocal and included the whole family in its various arguments. I also remember Miss Simpson came down and made this call standing right in front of Simpson. And that later when the police came, some minutes later, they secretly tape recorded a conversation between police and former husband and wife. And Miss Simpson did not want to press any charges. She then called Simpson the next day to apologize. I say all this only to show you that you cannot take anything for granted. You cannot, for instance, as in the Demoniak case, the so-called Ivan the Terrible, mm-hmm. the man who was on death row in Israel for a number of years, and then in a spectacular moment, the high court released him. But many in America who had followed the case grumbled, well, if he's not Ivan the Terrible, he's Ivan the Less Terrible. He did something else. That means you haven't learned anything. It's not good enough to say that Simpson is a notorious wife beater, even if he didn't commit the murders. So therefore, we are not interested or we can't afford to be bored or to drop this case because it has no heroes, no real heroes, no real villains, no angels, no demons, and so forth. After all, this is not a Saturday afternoon serial at the local Bijou or Fox. This is now a national issue, and to paraphrase Voltaire in talking about a trial of the century of the 18th century, that whether Simpson be guilty or innocent, the nation is disgraced. There has to be a process now of dialogue beyond race and rage, and that's why we used computer timelines and a kind of forensic language for this book, Killing Time.
That reference, by the way, is, of course, to the Dreyfus case. At least one Bay Area author is writing an article, perhaps which may result in a book, comparing the two cases. A couple of points very quickly, Don, because there's so much in your book, and we have a great deal of information to try to at least touch on before the hour interview is over. With regard to domestic abuse, two points that you bring out. First of all, again, Nicole was supposedly, according to the prosecution and the media hype, living in constant terror of her husband, yet 3 weeks before she was murdered, she held a pizza party at Rockingham.
Oh, yes. There are many contradictions. She had been ill also that spring, and Simpson had been there bringing her food and nursing her. They had a complex relationship, and it has been badly stereotyped in order to lay the logic down for the prosecution's case. But as I say, they did not present one expert because the momentum wasn't there. The pattern wasn't there. And while it's true that people, men who murder their wives, the statistics show, also have abused them.
Mm-hmm.
But the reverse is not true. That is, men who abuse their wives do not murder them. Now, maybe that sounds unclear. If someone murders his wife, you will often find there's been a pattern of abuse and momentum leading to murder. Now, that's clear.
Mm-hmm.
But men who abuse their wives do not murder them.
As a rule.
As a rule. And when we say as a rule, we mean in the high percentiles. It's a very rare situation.
Before getting to some of the aspects of the physical evidence and the detailed, painstaking analysis that you and your co-author present, one of the points you make also, something that I did not realize until I read your book, was that Nicole testified at her divorce hearing that the 1989 incident was the only time O.J. Simpson hit her.
That is right. And the photographs and the rhetoric and the 911 calls and so on, the conflation of phenomenon surrounding the 1989 has been retailed in such a way as to give the public the impression that you had a sort of daily abuse going on.
Right.
But that is not the case.
One of the points that winds throughout your book concerns a timeline, and indeed this dominated the trial. The analysis that you and your co-author present is extremely detailed, and I think that it would be impossible to do justice to it in the context of a radio interview. I encourage members of the listening audience, by the way, to buy this book and to read this painstaking analyses, really, because you present various timelines. By 10:42, however, on the evening of Sunday, June 12, 1994, the prosecution had to admit that O.J. Simpson was home.
Yes, the prosecution's timeline is that at 10:03, Mr. Simpson called his friend Paula Barbieri on his cellular phone, was unable to reach her, and therefore went berserk. Committed the murders around 10:15, and then did or did not use the next 20 minutes or so to hide guilty clothes and weapon. But at any rate, by 10:42, had snuck home and had, by happenstance, banged into the wall of the guest house where Mr. Cato Kalin resided. At that time, according to the prosecution, Mr. Simpson dropped a bloody glove. He then staggered around to the front of the house and entered and was seen by a young limousine driver who was waiting to take him to the airport. So the prosecution's murder clock closes down at about 10:42. And the reason we know can be sure of that time is that there's a Mr. Kalin, when he hears the knock on his wall, asks his friend on the telephone, "Did you hear an earthquake?" And he then hangs up, and that hang-up is computerized on his telephone log. Now, we use clocks, that one and a number of others, because there were telephone calls made by the various principals that night, again and again, and so you have an entire grammar of computerized anchored clocks. We also used, as you know, unofficial clocks, such as people walking dogs, and we use the restaurant time clock and time links on the credit card for people who were at the restaurant and later walked past the murder scene. And then at a further remove, we used melting ice cream and cooling bath water and such like clocks. But as Einstein said, anything which shows the passage of time is a clock. And there were many clocks, both official and unofficial, that night. And it's of those that we built the timeline. And David, a common example of a timeline at this moment is the hapless Officer Jewell in Atlanta, the putative Olympic bomber who has been spared so far by his timeline.
There are a great many points that I want to touch on with regard to your book, Don. We're almost finished with the first half hour of the interview. I'd like to present some things almost in terms of bullet points, or perhaps knife points would be a better term under the circumstances, yeah. And ask you to do the impossible, like O.J. Simpson, only in an academic sense, and encapsulate as briefly and succinctly as possible some of the central information that you present in regard to this. Now, the prosecution's timeline, as we observed in the passage I read earlier, underwent a great many mutations. One of the things that they did was to toss out or in some cases abuse witnesses, and these were witnesses who thought O.J. was guilty because their information did not coincide with their timeline. I'm thinking of Robert Heitzer and Jill Shively.
Yeah, exactly, David. It's ironic that without exception, Simpson's alibi depends on ear witnesses who believed him guilty and could not understand why the prosecution abused them and did not use them as centerpieces in the prosecution case, and barely understand to this day how it is that their times arrived at in various ways, including telephone time logs, the killing time is placed at 10:32 to 10:42 on that night, and that's over a dozen witnesses. Only one for the prosecution places it earlier at about 10:20. So, but the shouts, the screams, the calling, the voices, and the barking dog are heard between 10:32 and 10:42. But, of course, with 10:45 being the last sighting of a car racing away south in the opposite direction of the Simpson estate from the murder scene, and that prosecution timeline basically excludes Simpson from the crime because he cannot be home bumping into the wall and dropping the glove at the same time. However, with that in mind, we went one step further and conducted what we called the Bronco experiment.
We're going to talk about that.
And we'll pick that up a little later.
Yeah, because I want to go into that in a little bit more detail, but it as briefly as possible. Robert Heitstra and Jill Shively, a couple of the witnesses who felt O.J. was guilty, but whose information was thrown out by the prosecution.
That's right. One sees what could be a white Bronco speeding away at 10:45, and Shively sees a man at 10:50, which she first thinks is Marcus Allen, but later decides was O.J. Simpson. But in any case, those times are too late.
And Robert Heitstra also was actually humiliated by the prosecution.
He was indeed. The various working class witnesses were trashed, as they say, by the prosecution, which in some ways got through to the jury and helps explain their loathing of the prosecution and their very quick decision, I think.
We have been speaking with Donald Freed, who, along with Raymond Briggs, is the co-author of Killing Time, the first full investigation, copyright 1996, in hardcover by Macmillan, a book setting forth the evidence and the circumstances surrounding the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman, and I think a book which would provoke a great many important questions in the mind of an objective observer. For Donald Freed, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.